The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
In one sense, we're destroying capitalism and don't know what system will replace it. And that's what you see with the orchestrated fiscal policy initiatives, monetary policy initiatives. We want a world where there is no more business cycle. We want a world where there is no more pain. We want a world that is utopian in nature and goes beyond the vagaries of the market and the cruelties of capitalism.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, sometimes you think about some of these companies as the living dead. But before we get to that, you said that your daughter, who didn't know what we were going to talk about today, got up singing a song with zombies in it.
It's a song from the 90s by the Cranberries. And over again, they have the word zombie. And I have no idea why she actually thinks of herself as the 80s girl. That's kind of the era of music that she likes. So
and
why?
She stands about, what, 4'5" right now?
That's right. So, yeah, I woke up to, as I'm finishing my thoughts and notes for the commentary today, I hear in the background, zombie. Yeah.
Well, and you've been talking about zombies because you've been talking about some of these companies. Well, look at Tesla. Okay. That zombie phrase, by the way, before we jump in here, was used back during the last tech stock bubble. Zombie companies, it's... What that would represent are companies that actually are running almost purely on debt, virtually no profit, yet their stock is skyrocketing.
Yeah, it's old world to think that you need earnings and profits. New world to think about leverage and the potential of what gets unpacked from sort of the pro forma bliss. Tesla is probably squarely in that camp. And it's weird because, how do you consider it a zombie with a recent market cap of $450 billion?
Isn't that amazing? Almost $500 billion. I mean, that's more than almost all the other automakers combined.
The company loses money on car production, but shows earnings exclusively from its sale of carbon credits. I mean, let that sink in. The sale of carbon credits.
What the heck is a carbon credit anyway?
It's a different kind of zombie. Yeah. True. Their production is about 370,000 vehicles. And in a bizarre twist of financial market fate, and this is like casino, when you look at the behavior relating to investors and Tesla, the company is worth more than 9 of its competitors combined. Those 9 competitors produce 50 million cars per year.
Okay, so let's compare that again. Tesla sells 367,000 vehicles. Okay, they're worth almost $500 billion. And that is more than all these 9 competitors that sell, what'd you say, 50 million cars per year?
Yeah, but you used to say when you're talking about McDonald's, you make it up on volume. Well, today you make it up on carbon credits. Why bother with cars when you can sell carbon credits? It's the wave of the future. For the record, we are not short Tesla. We are not long Tesla. We are neutral in our opinion. Well, we're not neutral in our opinions, but at least we are in our positions.
Well, and I'm thinking that's probably good because how long can you print free money? Granted, you get something for free, but it will ultimately cost you everything. But just to show that you're not picking just on Tesla, let's look at the NASDAQ, because the NASDAQ, if you really look at advancing shares versus declining shares, it's signaling something much different than the price.
Yeah. By the way, I'm not a skeptic when it comes to the electric vehicle revolution. It's just a question of who wins, because usually the early adopters of new technology are not the ones who end up winning. And my guess is the production prowess of those 9 other Tesla competitors, the ones who are already producing and selling 50 million cars, it's actually not that difficult to pivot towards a different kind of offering if the market demands it. So, you've got Rivian, you've got a whole host of other companies out there that will produce electric vehicles. And 20 years from now, 30 years from now, the landscape will look very different. But you mentioned NASDAQ. Yeah, Stephen Hochberg. I often read him on the Elliott Wave, and we've had him as a guest on the commentary before. And he's noted that NASDAQ breadth continues to deteriorate And we talked about breath versus breadth. And this is bad breadth, as in advancing shares minus declining shares.
So it's a simple calculation. You're just basically saying how much is advancing versus how much is declining.
Exactly. How many companies are moving up? How many companies are moving lower? And so the advance minus decline, it's the lowest since March, and places a downside target, that is, Stephen does, NASDAQ about 9,350 to 10,000, a fairly wide range. That would be like the opening act. I think the headliner is still to come, a lot more downside in NASDAQ, but a first destination of, say, 9,350.
Yeah, so it's not just the NASDAQ. Anytime you look at a group, Dave, it's good to look at who are the winners, who are the losers, and it does that outweigh. You were talking about subtracting declining shares from advancing shares on the NASDAQ. But if you look at the S&P 500, you've mentioned this before, the gains are coming from just a very, very small group. It's not the 80-20 rule. It's, what would you say, 494 decliners to six gainers.
Right. You know, Bill King's been on the program a number of times. We'd love to have him as a guest. And he hails from the Windy City. So does Jim Bianco. And they're both rigorous in their thinking, have a strong research and trading background. And it was Jim Bianco in his Bianco research that pointed that out. Six stocks account for the entirety of the S&P 500 gains year to date. So 494 are kind of a drag on performance, dragging the numbers lower. Meanwhile, you get Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Microsoft, and Alphabet, what everyone refers to as Google. They contributed, those six stocks contributed 100% of this year's gain. Hmm. So again, we're talking about breadth. Breadth is an issue for all your indices, NASDAQ and S&P 500 included. But when you have these kinds of breadth readings, what you can say is, not necessarily to the day, but in the near future, watch out below.
You know, last week we talked about how Powell is probably not going to be remembered well when we look back at inflation, because he's adding fuel to a fire that's actually hitting new highs. And, you know, it's just so different, Dave, than when I was coming out of high school and Paul Volcker was doing just the opposite.
And it reminds me of Greenspan, because in some senses, Greenspan came in with a certain idealism and then was converted to central bank pragmatism fairly quickly. What he had understood in terms of sort of an Ayn Randian perfect world all of a sudden got scrubbed, washed, disinfected, and he became a different man in the context of working at the Fed. And I thought Powell coming in was taking a different approach. And in fact, his first moves were to tighten credit appropriately, given sort of the loose credit that had been abundant since the global financial crisis.
And then he had a change of heart.
And I think that's market driven, and it's definitely pragmatic in nature. But thanks to Jim Grant's team for pointing out sort of the bookends, what began as one bookend, October 6th, 1979, that was the launch of the Volcker Action Plan. The impetus was to destroy inflation, to cut off growth in bank reserves. And Powell offers the other bookend, the opposite action plan, 41 years later. Our goal now, according to the more pragmatic Powell, is to stoke inflation and to use all tools at the Fed's disposal to improve employment and higher wages. So we go back to the old mandate. The mandate for our central bank is, I quote, to promote maximum employment, stable prices, and moderate long-term interest rates. Right. And so that's the goal of the Fed. Of course, where we would perhaps want to linger is the open interpretation of price stability and the loose understanding of moderate long-term rates. Those two things, in case you thought you knew what they meant, check your dictionary. There's multiple definitions.
We've got to remind ourselves over and over how it is that you beat inflation in that world. I mean, interest rates have to rise. You know, we had Taylor on, and he was basically saying that the Taylor rule says you must have this much more in interest than inflation for the system to work. Now we have the opposite. We have repression. So what we're really being told isn't that the Fed needs to stoke inflation. We're really being told that we're not going to be able to keep up as savers.
And I guess the main point for the Fed and for others who are looking at our total quantity of debt, which we talked about a little bit last week in terms of gross debt, Bloomberg notes that the debt pile is getting cheaper as it grows. And what they're looking at is the interest payments have declined by 10% in the first 11 months of the fiscal year.
Right. And that is the Fed. That's not the market that's doing that. The Fed is doing that.
Pushing interest rates lower. So the Congressional Budget Office is confident that the cost to finance our debt, it's going to get cheaper from here. And my guess is that they are talking, that is the Congressional Budget Office, is talking to the central bank community. And they are. They're confident that the guiding of rates lower, that, as you say, they're responsible for pushing these rates lower. The guiding of those rates lower by the seen administrative hand of the Fed. We like to think of capitalism in the unseen hand. Well, this is the seen administrative hand of the Fed. There is a belief that they will succeed. And the evidence is with the market effect, right? The average yield on U.S. debt since last December has declined from 2.4% to 1.7%.
Well, of course we can afford more. You know, if you can continue to pay less and less for that debt, why not borrow?
And that's precisely what happened here in the last 12 months, even with home mortgages. If you look at the new record set at 2.86% on the 30-year mortgage, you can now buy 9.3% more house for the same money involved, right? So you lower rates and it lets you buy more. Now, the flip side of that is you've got consumers who are buying and have more exposure from a balance sheet standpoint to a liability. They think they're buying an asset, but when you're attaching debt to it, there is this liability component. And we all forget about what a liability does in aggregate, what it does as a single item on a balance sheet. And of course, if you don't have a fixed rate, or if you have to roll over your debt, then all of a sudden, you've got real issues. So this is the official argument. And so goes the market's blasé reaction to our increased deficits. This year, it's three times what it was last year. It's estimated at $3.7 trillion and would be more, but you've stalled out in terms of fiscal spending. Nobody wants to agree to additional fiscal spending prior to the election, right? You might be seen as helping or hurting someone, and nobody wants to take those risks.
Okay, so I think we have to stop for a moment and say, what has changed in our lifetime and what's actually changed just over the last 10 years and especially the last 6 months? We'd have to say that we've eliminated, to a degree, the market forces. Okay. It used to be called the bond vigilante. And the bond vigilante was you and I basically saying, no, I'm not going to put my money here. I demand higher rates. At this point, we're being displaced by whatever you want to call it, the anti-bond vigilante, which is somebody who can print money for free, the Federal Reserve. So when money is free, it's free, but ultimately, it costs us everything, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I can't remember, memory's a little fuzzy. I think Ed Yardini was with Merrill Lynch years ago. And in the 80s, he's said to have coined the phrase bond vigilante. There is a new market presence, and it's the anti-vigilante. Mm. And the anti-vigilante is the Federal Reserve.
Right.
Right? So investors appear to exert, let's call it insufficient power over governments. In other words, the old bond vigilante would come in and sell their bonds, force rates higher as a penalty for running large deficits and an expression of risk quantification.
And interest rates rose.
That's right. Yeah. Bond prices dropped as they sold. Interest rates rose. And there was a certain discipline applied to the fixed income world as a result of that. The anti-vigilante basically steps in and neutralizes any of that. And again, so today we've got investors without sufficient power to override the government's edicts and wishes. And what are we talking about? Fed purchases of government debt this year of total about $1.8 trillion. That's, well, I take that back. That's since March.
How do you compete with that? If you're the general market, how do you compete with a Fed that can just throw $1.8 trillion into keeping interest rates low?
Yeah. And they're averaging $80 billion a month in treasury purchases, not to mention the mortgage-backed securities and corporates. So your all-in number is closer to $120 billion a month. So we can shoulder an even larger debt burden. Again, going back to this mountain of debt that grows, that seems to be getting cheaper as time goes on, at least according to that Bloomberg article, we can shoulder an even larger debt burden if, and this is the key, if rates can be bought down to ever lower levels.
So are they caught between a rock and a hard place, or have they just chosen, they just basically say, at this point, we don't need the markets, we're just going to print money?
Well, the math works, and that's what they're doing, is they're making the math work. It is a tenuous situation. I mean, it's one that requires a willingness to be on the hook for unlimited sums of money. Again, that's as the role of anti-vigilante. And of course, my contention for years has been that you can have some smart PhD that makes the math work. And that person, as good as they are with the equations, can be oblivious to the X factors, which can make a perfect equation on paper turn into a real-world absurdity and ultimately a market disaster.
I had asked you what has changed. Another thing that's changed over my lifetime is a millionaire used to be a millionaire. I remember when people would retire, they'd say, if we have $1 million in the bank and can earn 5% on that million, that was a sweet $50,000 a year just from the interest on that money. Those days are gone.
Yeah, the cost for growth in the economy and in the markets, and this version, this current modern version of market stability, in large measure comes from the value extraction is from the class of savers and investors that would otherwise have seen passive income on their savings. So you talk about $1 million, and that used to be the magic 5% that you could generate on. And Grants lays it out this way. He says, when the 10-year treasury fetched 5%, $1 million nest egg annually threw off $50,000. At a yield of 2.5%, a saver needed $2 million to generate the same $50,000. Today, at 75 basis points, that's 0.75% yield, that saver or public pension fund or insurance company would need $6.7 million. And if the bond bulls, or Kevin, you and I could say, if the Congressional Budget Office or the anti-vigilante, otherwise known as the Fed, if they got their wish and the 10-year yield tumbled to 0.25%, seekers of $50,000 a year from the 10-year point on the Treasury curve would have to front $20 million. Are yields going to zero is the question that Jim asks. If instead they stopped at a single basis point, our thrifty retiree would need $500 million in savings for that same $50,000 in income.
We've had a couple of guests in the past say, well, at this point, the winners and the losers are being chosen. And I think what we're talking about right now is that we're probably not the chosen winner.
Exactly. I think that fairly well illustrates who wins and who loses in the game of low to negative interest rates. Because on the one hand, you're subsidizing a higher debt load, as Bloomberg points out in the article. It's titled, Debt Pile Gets Cheaper as It Grows. And that's at the expense of anyone who sought to save and maintain a modicum of independence from the state. Because remember, we have this social safety net we refer to as Social Security. But for anyone who does want that extra layer of protection, kind of take ownership of the fact that your future needs to be secured by you, then the savings which you've painstakingly set aside through the years, well, guess what? Unfortunately, you are a part of the fodder necessary to keep this kind of game going.
So the magic 5% is not impossible, but it forces increased risk-taking. So you had mentioned treasuries paying 5%. Mm-hmm. What we're now talking about is, yeah, somebody can go out and actually get that 5%, but what are they giving up?
Yeah, and it's the increase in risk-taking. It's the yield chasing when the magic 5% yield is going through its own version of an ice age. And that's what we have. We have a fixed income ice age where we're going towards lower and lower temperatures.
But does anybody understand? I mean, really, what, like John Maynard Keynes said, you know, one in a million really understand this.
Because they don't understand. The Fed will never be required to take responsibility, and they're not going to step up and volunteer to take responsibility for a negative outcome where volatility, if and when it does emerge, ends up testing the value and the solvency of those entities with bloated debt levels. You know, again, we're at risk, and risk taking has a disproportional cost to the insignificant rewards on offer. I mean, so look, high yield debt is a classic case in point. If you look at the J&K ETF, it's a high yield ETF, delivers approximately 5% in income, but the volatility is not the same as Grant's illustrated 10-year treasury.
Again, we're talking about retirement paper. I mean, this is the money that you saved all your life. You can't lose it in the last few years of your life.
Junk bonds, the most likely to default of any paper. Again, this is pro-cyclical, works great in an up market, terrible in a down market, occasionally very painful. I mean, last week we talked about the BBB paper, and this is the stuff that creates ultimately, as you look onto the horizon, The BBB paper is the stuff that creates a major supply problem for the junk market. And I'm talking about an oversupply problem where the junk bond market is flooded with BBB paper. This is the focal point. This is where you see the Fed is going to have to intervene. I mean, look, we had March, they averted a major market rout. And that was with, J&K being off 21%. Roll the clock back to 2008 and 2009, that downturn, and you had the same product down 45%.
Mm-hmm.
45%. I mean, so this is a speculative fixed income product. March 2020 was headed there. And then the Fed pulled the anti-vigilante moves and started buying corporate credit, unclogged the ETF products that were in full-blown liquidation mode. And so the losses were only 21%. But amazingly, far less downside in junk bonds. And think about this. Less downside in junk bonds than in Tesla stock. Really a volatile asset, and probably why the S&P 500 did not include Tesla in the mix, because it just in today, out tomorrow is the most likely outcome there.
The thing that's tough about this too is this anti-vigilante move. If we look at it from another perspective, it's actually very calming, because volatility is what actually works us up. I mean, when we see ups and downs, the anti-vigilantes, the guys who can come in and replace the market with free printed paper, they do smooth things out. They destroy volatility, but in a way, it also removes your emotions. It's like touching a stove, Dave, that's burning your fingers, but you don't know. You don't feel it.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've talked about it in terms of cold death. The anti-vigilante role is really an anti-volatility role. And the problem is that volatility is what you have when a price of an asset is changing constantly. And that back and forth of it should be priced at this, no at that, no at this, no at that. That is the market function figuring out where value exists and when something is appropriately priced.
Right.
The anti-vigilante role eliminates the volatility. You've got smoothing. You eliminate risk of loss. The cost for that stability, is there a cost? And I think, yes, this is where it's very clear. You've got pension funds, insurance companies, and retirees all facing the same sort of desperation. You've got a ratcheting up of risk as the anti-volatility central bank playbook reduces all assets to lower and lower return propositions. With implicitly higher and higher risks. You don't see those risks on the front edge because, again, it looks safer because you don't see any movement.
Right. You don't feel it. You don't feel the volatility. But we're also talking about grandma and grandpa. These are people who saved all their lives, and they're seeing BBB and junk paper and Tesla stock as smooth as what 10-year treasuries used to be. This is an all or nothing. This has to work.
Well, and maybe not Tesla as a smooth line. That one's been particularly volatile. But I think the trend continues until everyone, including grandma, is forced to be a gambler.
Right.
And that was kind of our casino reference last week. But again, the Fed will in no way take responsibility for negative outcomes induced by the behavioral shifts their policies created. Is there a choice in this? Does the individual investor have to play? I mean, can they say no to becoming sort of the gambling granny?
Isn't that what's happening? I mean, with the gold price may not be spectacular right now, but isn't gold signaling right now that some of the people are saying you can have your purchased with free money, low volatility and false stability. I'm going to step outside of the system and go back onto a personal gold standard.
Yeah. And I think it's, I mean, on that same note of taking responsibility for negative outcomes, the Fed has never seen that their money printing gambit and easy credit schemes are a contributor to wealth disparity. Somehow that happens in the marketplace, but their actions are not connected, don't connect those dots. At least they don't connect those dots. And so we've had this radical asset price inflation as a result of monetary policies. And with that comes the haves having more and the have-nots having less on a relative basis. And is it any surprise that we have a tearing of the social fabric? I wouldn't put it to envy as much as I would, again, this issue of desperation. Because on the one hand, you've got easy money and an easy life as long as you had assets to appreciate in that environment. But if you didn't have assets to appreciate and you've got the growing consequences of inflation showing up elsewhere, yours is a pressured life. Yours is a life that requires dual incomes. Yours is a life that, if you get a pink slip, is incredibly stressful because it's not as if you had enough to save. You were living paycheck to paycheck in the first place.
Well, and if you're retired, you're forced to gamble. I mean, even if you're grandpa or grandma, you're forced to gamble and you may not want to.
Yeah, so the opt-out you mentioned is gold. And so is this self-serving? Sure. I mean, the first and best opt-out is gold. But remember this. Gold represents a very valuable positioning in a transition. And all you need is a modicum of stability in market transitions that have historically basically been a move to cash. So when you want to get out of the stock market, the bond market, the real estate market, you sell the asset and you move to what? Historically, that was cash. Cash was gold, right? And a little bit more on that in a minute. But think about it in these terms. Think lifeboat, for lack of a better word picture. You're uncomfortable temporarily above the water, but that's a significantly better position to be in than being irreparably below the waterline.
The question that I have for myself and the listeners and you is, can we transition to a new paradigm, though? I have been raised in a capitalist system, or what I thought was a capitalist system. Richard Duncan came along and said, no, it hasn't been capitalist for a long time. It's creditism. And, you know, we have Doug Noland, who talks about the moneyness of credit. They're saying similar things, but capitalism, which means, you know, you profit at a business, you save, and you benefit from the savings, those days are over.
Yeah, in one sense, we're destroying capitalism and don't know what system will replace it. And there is a significant transition afoot. The market economy of the past has given way, as our guest Russell Napier said years ago, to command and control dynamics. And that's what you see with the orchestrated fiscal policy initiatives, monetary policy initiatives. We want a world where there is no more business cycle. We want a world where there is no more pain. We want a world that is utopian in nature and goes beyond the vagaries of the market and the cruelties of capitalism.
But if no business dies, okay, part of capitalism is creative destruction, right? If nothing dies, don't we go back to this zombie that your daughter was singing about? And
Actually,
you told me about a dream she had recently.
That's right.
Yeah, she's thinking too much about zombies right now, Dave.
I know.
But we are talking about zombie companies, because if you let nothing die in business, all you have is a bunch of zombies.
No, it's okay for that to happen. I mean, what happens to the capitalist when capitalism is no more? What happens to his or her capital when a free enterprise system is replaced by the financial equivalent of the zombie apocalypse? I mentioned this dream that my daughter had. She came into my bedroom this weekend as she woke and said that her dreams were the worst she'd ever had. Zombies everywhere. The living dead. And I responded compassionately. This was, I think, Sunday morning. Honey, it's more real than you think. And I happened to be on my phone looking at Sunday's Financial Times, and there was an article there. The number of U.S. zombie companies is nearing peak levels we haven't seen since the year 2000.
Okay, but only in the McIlvaney household is your daughter going to come out and tell you that she's had a dream of zombies, and you're like, it's worse than you think, and then you tie it into what we're talking about today.
The headline read, "Pandemic Debt Creates a New Generation of Zombie Companies." And the issue then, back in the year 2000, as it is now, is that you get to a point where your operating profits are less than the interest owed on your debt.
Say that one more time.
Operating profits are less. Below the interest owed on your debt. That's a bit of a problem. But you can continue to play this game if there's easy money, right? So I thought the conversation was seamless. I think what she wanted me to do was empathize with the fear of being chased down by an army of life-filled corpses who would either eat her or pass along their dead, undead status.
Okay, but Dad, is that too much to ask? I mean, I remember I didn't dream of zombies, but I'll never forget my first skeleton dream when I was 3 or 4 years old.
Well,
same thing.
Okay, so if you're listening to this and you're a psychologist, cut me a break. Parenting is an imperfect process on the best of days, and I'm sure that you'd be critical of World War Z. Maybe it was a little strong for family night, But that was a long time ago.
Oh, come on. Come on. You didn't do Family Z as a family.
Okay. World War Z.
So, okay, but zombies don't exist. The bottom line is the zombies we see in movies, they don't exist. Or if they do, I haven't seen one. But the companies you're talking about.
We create the conditions for corporate and banking zombies routinely. More routinely, it would seem, since we left the gold standard and stable currency value. So the zombification of corporations is roughly in line with central bank accommodation in the markets. Because in essence, accommodation is the removal of consequence for poor capital allocation decisions in the life of a business and an allowance to just keep on going long past the point at which you should have been dead.
Okay, you remember when the tech stock bubble was getting at its peak in February of 2000. How many zombie companies did we have, you know, in relation to the other companies at that time, the year 2000?
Yeah, the last time we hit peak Z was that year 2000, 2001, around 15% of the Russell 3000. So Looking at smaller cap companies, peak Z, it took the global financial crisis and mass bankruptcies to bring us from 15% of the Russell 3000 in that category to under 7%. So finally, kind of a cleansing and a washout. Now we're back to peak Z again, 15% again.
Okay. And again, that is a company that actually is paying more interest than their earnings. Is that correct? Their
yeah.
profits. Yeah.
Yeah. Jun Zhou of the Luthold Group asks, what happens if all of a sudden capital markets dry up and they can't refinance or pay down their debt? How will they roll it over or even afford the interest expense? That's a good question. Mm-hmm. That's a good question. Ask the anti-vigilante if a domino effect of tightening credit is acceptable. And of course, the answer is no.
Sure, so they can't.
How many trillions is the Fed willing to purchase? And how long before the benign, again, what we consider today low levels of inflation, shift to levels that impact consumer behavior and create a new set of variables for, oh, these are scary words, inflation expectations.
Okay.
Those are the inputs which the anti-vigilante cannot control.
And that's my question. Can they control that? Because in the 1970s, you know, you brought up Greenspan. All right. Now, I have to admit, I was about 11 years old when this happened. But when Alan Greenspan was put in charge of the Treasury, this is before the Fed, he was tasked with controlling inflation expectations. And so they had these buttons that they handed out to people called WIN, Whip Inflation Now, W-I-N, Whip Inflation Now. It had zero effect, okay, because these guys can print as much money as they want, and they can control volatility for a while. They can control market stability. Maybe they can even add to employment some of the things they've talked about. But they can't control inflation expectations except for through perception. In other words, telling people that there's no inflation.
Well, right. So you go back to the Greenspan era. This is a fascinating shift because Greenspan, they used to say, spoke Greenspeak. And it was a language that only Greenspan understood. And so basically, you could control the market by baffling them with BS. And that was the reality, is you didn't understand what he said, but he must have understood what he said, and he meant it. He said it with conviction, therefore you had to believe it. So you were being directed and you were being controlled through a language that was not clear. Now, fast forward to the age of Powell and Bernanke, and what do you have? You have forward guidance. And forward guidance gives you the impression that these folks are sitting there like the Oracle of Delphi, some sort of a seer, knowing the future and saying, this is where we're going. This is where we're guiding it. This is what we have under control. It's the same thing. You're managing perceptions, but one was literally baffling with BS, and the other is now telling you exactly so clearly where we are going that you cannot doubt the certainty and the certitude with which it was spoken.
Again, it's managing perceptions. It's pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, because what we're seeing is we're seeing the things that everybody looks at, which are the indexes on the stocks, the value of bonds, the interest that's paid. All of that can be seen, but strangely enough, inflation seems to be the invisible element behind the zombies, right. And it's sucking the value out of everyone's buying power.
Yeah, the anti-vigilante cannot control inflation expectations, because inflation expectations tie to a mental construct and an emotional response. It's the gray matter of the mind, which is beyond a price that you can pay for purchasing. You can buy a bond. You can buy some other asset class and influence pricing, right? But the gray matter, you can only influence to a certain point. Perhaps you can coerce it for a time, but it really is theoretically not for sale.
You had talked about an opt-out. Okay, if we've got this invisible monster that's sucking, it's zombifying companies, and it's sucking the value out of your currency. You know, I came to work for your dad back when I was 24 years old, and your family, and a $20 gold piece. I was introduced to the old $20 gold piece. At that time, it was about $500. You know, just a few years before that, it was $35 when the company started. And I have, over the last 33 years, recommended people buy this $20 gold piece. You know, 100 years ago, it was worth $20. It was worth $35. And in the early 70s, when your dad started this business, it was worth about $500 when I came in 1987. Isn't it amazing that that almost perfectly matches what we're talking about, the zombification of companies and the destroying of the life of a currency?
Yeah, and you could look at it as a long-term bull market in gold or a long-term bear market in our money. The Federal Reserve was launched in 1913. An ounce of gold was equal to $20.67. So your $20 gold piece, coin of the realm here in the United States, that was cash in that day. And today, we believe in currency and price stability because we have no reason not to. That's it. We believe what the Fed says because we have no reason not to. And after all, with 600 PhDs, who are we to question them? Vast appeal to authority, which is very effective. But let's go back to the Fed's mandate, particularly on the two points subject to interpretation. On the one hand, you've got price stability. On the other hand, you've got moderate bond yields, moderate in quotes. Full employment, we're going to leave alone because it's not a challenging subject. Smaller the number it gets, the better we all are. But as for price stability, your $20 gold price is now $2,000 per coin versus the original $20. Hmm. That implies a 99% loss of purchasing power in the paper which the Fed is supposed to be managing. And again, the first and primary mandate is price stability. So how do you grade it? 99% loss of purchasing power is their demonstration over 100 plus years of what price stability looks like. Yeah. And it's a very gradual decay, which has not set the investment community on edge. But is there a point where if you are either historically aware or even just budget constrained and asking, if the system that we have today,
again, creditism,
correct.
Not capitalism, creditism.
Is it working? And if inflation is a factor driving monthly frustrations over your costs as they increase and income constraints as they stay relatively flat, can we ignore these things? Can we ignore the fact that M2 growth is year over year up 29%? Mm-hmm. Can we ignore the month to month increase in CPI, the Consumer Price Index, which in July had the biggest jump in three decades, ex energy? So at 0.6%, the average investor still looks at it as a rounding error, though it puts us at or above that target of 2% for the full year. You tell me. I mean, this is where I do think we begin to have this reality check.
Okay, but there's double
percent loss of purchasing power.
Maybe it's well-meaning, but it sounds like hypocrisy to me because the monetary policymakers are basically saying we want to give you stability, but you just now talked about losing 99% of the purchasing power of the currency that we save in, not just spend in, we save in.
Yeah, I mean, hypocrisy would be one thing. I would call it well-intentioned duplicity. Monetary policymakers for decades have silently accepted the duplicity of creating inflation while claiming to want price stability. And it's for a greater good, and there's a way to rationalize it from an ethical standpoint, depending on how you structure ethics. So January 2012, Ben Bernanke told us that the best definition of price stability was a 2% inflation target. And, you know, historically, again, this goes back to which dictionary are you using? What's your reference point? Because 0% up to that point, at least amongst the common person, was the acceptable level of inflation.
Right, because it's theft. I mean, if someone says, yes, I can steal 2% from you every year, that's stability. That's not stability. That's theft.
So zero was the expectation up to that point. Now it's 2% is the target and the expectation. Okay, now, current tense, to achieve the 2%, we have to tolerate, this is as of Jackson Hole a few weeks ago, we have to tolerate higher levels of inflation for longer periods of time above the 2% target originally put in place in 2012.
Okay, so let's think that through. What they're basically saying is now it's not 2%, but it's more than 2% because we hadn't quite gotten to 2% before.
And I think as an investor, you have to also translate it this way. We're going to deal with longer periods of negative real returns. That's how you should read it. If they're increasing interest rates, and yet, you know, you look at Richard Clarida making it clear that interest rate caps are around the corner. Negative real rates are a clear present and future reality. So this is where I do think you go back to the Summers-Barsky thesis, which argues the gold price will move inverse to real returns. Real meaning your inflation adjusted return. So if you have a positive real rate of return, you have a clear reason to go buy something else. If stocks are going to give you a 5% rate of return above inflation, why wouldn't you choose that as opposed to sitting in gold, right? Same with bonds. If you go back to that magic 5%, great. But now if inflation is eating your lunch and interest rates have been capped, where do you go?
Have you noticed the Wall Street giants like Goldman Sachs, Credit Suisse? They're coming in and they're actually, I don't know if they're trying to save face or because they know the direction of gold is higher, but they've even raised their expectations for next year.
Gradually for some and more radically for others, Goldman lifted its price target to $2,300 for next year. Credit Suisse to $2,500 for next year. Bank of America with the largest number from any of the big banks, $3,000 an ounce. That's better than 50% gain from here. And I think this is what it comes down to. You've got debasement. That is a global currency phenomenon, not just where Biden likes to hang out. But and it's happening everywhere. So your investor demand is also global. Demand for the metals is global in nature. And we have an official pronouncement from the Fed of higher rates of inflation coming, provided, by the way, provided under the cover of COVID-related demand slack. So, look, we've got disinflation. We're going to have to run inflation a little bit hot. They actually have the perfect cover for shifting their policy, even as we're moving into a naturally higher inflation environment.
Deflation is the wrong boogeyman, is what you're telling us, where the invisible inflation boogeyman is the one that's been sucking us dry.
Well, you know, I don't have a great amount of love for Jeffrey Curry over at Goldman Sachs, mainly because sometimes I don't like hearing what people have to say. In 2013, he called the market top, and I should have paid more attention to him. He had...
In gold, you're talking.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And he had some good facts that I should have paid attention to, and I did not. But yeah, as head of global commodity research at Goldman Sachs, he said here in recent days, and frankly, this is what we've been harping on for years, Kevin. He says, ironically, the greater the deflationary concerns that policymakers must fight today, the greater the debt buildup and the higher the inflationary risks are in the future. The deflationary shock caused by the pandemic drives the need to expand balance sheets to support demand today. The resulting expanded balance sheets and the vast money creation spurs the debasement fears, which in turn create greater likelihood that at some point in the future, after economic activity is normalized, there will be incentives for central banks and governments to allow inflation to drift higher to reduce the accumulated debt burden. Now, that's the end of the quote. But what are we talking about? At some point in the future, we've just had a monumental shift. We went from 0% to 2%. That shift, we went from zero. It took us basically 100 years of assuming that 0% was the right inflation target. And then in 2012, we move it to 2%. Now we move it to some number above 2% that gives us an average that's appropriate to whatever we think it should be, maybe at or above 2%.
So are you saying, in short order, that free money isn't free for forever. It'll ultimately cost you everything.
Well, it comes at a very high cost. So we come back to this issue of what is the cost of stability? What is the cost of this smoothing effect within the markets? And there are political reasons for the smoothing. There are pragmatic reasons. And we got into that with Richard Duncan a number of weeks ago. Call it survival and just not wanting to deal with negative outcomes. So let's just paper our way through this. That is the MO. That is what's happening in the current context. So yeah, any surprise to see Goldman shift its price targets, 2,300. Credit Suisse, 2,500. Bank of America, 3,000. I think that as time goes on and we continue to see balance sheet expansion, the revisions that they make will not be down, but will be up yet again.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, and you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.